Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
If you've listened to this show for a while, you know that if there's one tool I absolutely cannot live without, it's the Onyx Hunt app. I use Onyx year-round to mark spots, find new properties, access landowner information, and so much more. But throughout the year, I tend to use the app differently depending on what I'm doing. Right now, I'm always using it to double-check stream bank easements in the Driftless, and when I'm not doing that, I'm using the slope angle layer to look for pinch points or little knobs that a buck might be betting on. And of course, when I'm in the field scouting, the tracker feature is running at all times to paint a picture of how things move throughout a property. To learn more about all the other features that Onyx offers, head over to onyxmaps.com. We all know there's nothing worse than being cold and wet while you're trying to pursue your favorite game. That's why I trust Huntworth with all my hunting outerwear needs. This past fall was the warmest and driest I've ever been throughout an entire hunting season, and that's all thanks to Huntworth's heat boost technology and the DWR waterproof finish on their clothing. I've been wearing the Durham lightweight pants almost every time I hit the field, whether I'm chasing whitetails, busting brush for pheasants, or doing some postseason scouting, and you'd better believe that these things will be my go-to for turkey season as well, thanks to the waterproof seat and knee panels paired with the lightweight, breathable body. I'll probably rock the Grayling hoodie for the early season and eventually transition to the Fallon lightweight shirt when the hot late season starts, and all that's going to be in their Tarnan pattern, which I have absolutely fallen in love with over this past year. Go build your kit today at huntworthgear.com or visit the sporting goods section of your local Farm and Fleet or Fleet Farm to check it out in person. Southwest Wisconsin is home to one of the most unique trout fisheries in the country, with thousands of miles of spring-fed streams twisting their way through valleys, pastures, and prairies, and one of the best ways to experience this fishery is with a fly rod in hand. Good Chance Fly Fishing is your guide to all that the Driftless has to offer, whether you're an experienced angler or you're just looking to try something new and get into fly fishing. To find more info and book your trip, visit goodchanceflyfishing.com. If you've listened to this show before, I'm sure you've noticed that if there's one thing that keeps coming up over and over again, it's the importance of public lands and waters. Shoot, I'd venture to guess that 90% of what we talk about on this show takes place on public lands. We all love the challenges we face and the memories we create in these wild places, and we need folks who are in our corner to protect them as well. That's why we're proud to have partnered with the good folks over at the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. The Wisconsin BHA Chapter was formed to provide a voice for hunters and anglers throughout Wisconsin that want to protect our public land legacy, and everyone involved worked their tails off to protect public lands and access to those public lands and waters. To stay informed on all things public lands, the issues facing our public lands, policies that might affect them, and to cross paths with some of the coolest outdoorsmen out there, I highly encourage you to join the Wisconsin Chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, or at least the chapter of whatever state you live in. Also, be on the lookout for our Wisconsin Public Land Policy bonus episodes to keep you all in the loop on the legal side of conservation and how things get done here in Wisconsin. To join BHA, visit backcountryhunters.org/join, and to learn more about what's going on here in the Badger State, visit backcountryhunters.org/Wisconsin. What is going on, everyone? Welcome back to another episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman Podcast. I'm your host, Pierce Nellis, and this is your home for all things hunting, fishing, and conservation in the Badger State. Folks, I can't believe I'm finally saying this, but turkey season has officially arrived. This has been the longest winter, early spring, whatever you want to call it, that I can remember in recent memory, and I couldn't be more fired up that turkey season's finally here. Folks are getting out in the woods, seeing birds hitting the ground from this past weekend's youth season. Really fired up to be seeing that. And just tomorrow, as this comes out, Period A is going to kick off for the 2025 turkey season here in Wisconsin. And so I'm fired up. I hope you guys are as well. I hope the gear is all dialed. I hope the shotguns are patterning well. You've got everything you need to have some success in the coming weeks here as we head out into the woods. And so on that note, I figured what better way to kick off turkey season than to dive into a little bit of turkey biology here in the state of Wisconsin. So I brought in the Wisconsin DNR Assistant Wild Game Bird Ecologist, Alyssa Kackage. Now, Alyssa dropped a ton outstanding knowledge on us here in this episode that I'm excited for you to hear. We dive into all things turkey habitat, turkey management, how the zones are divvied up, population trends, different vocalizations, really everything you could possibly want to know about turkeys here in the state of Wisconsin. Now, I know we've done this in the past with deer, and I figured we really need to do this on birds because there's a heck of a lot of species that we are very fortunate to have here in the Badger State, and why not learn more about them? So this episode, especially our little chat on vocalizations, really shines some light on, I think, my calling strategy, what that's going to look like early season, and how that might change throughout the later seasons as well. And so I'm excited for you guys to hear this one. It's a really awesome conversation. Huge thanks to Alyssa for coming on the show to drop some knowledge on us. You can find all the information you could possibly want on the Wisconsin DNR website, which has been linked down in the episode show notes. It's got everything from season dates to all sorts of links and reports on turkey management here in Wisconsin. And I highly recommend you go check that out. I've been diving into the trout fishery surveys lately, and it's one of those things you kind of forget that all this is just public information. And there's a lot of great information out there. You know, we heard about it from Nathan Lederman, the Oneida County fisheries biologist. All of these reports are coming out every single year. DNR is responsible for putting out information to the public, and it's all there for us to go find and soak up and hopefully plan successful hunts off of. So with that, guys, huge thanks to Alyssa again, and let's get on to the episode. Talk to you next week. Thanks, guys. Joining me on this week's episode of the Wisconsin Sportsman, I have Alyssa Kackage, the Assistant Game Bird Specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Alyssa, how are we doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on. I'm excited to, this is going to drop the week before turkey season. So this is going to be we've done one turkey episode here so far, talking some tactics, but this is, I think the first actual, like, scientifically backed turkey conversation that we'll have had on the Wisconsin Sportsman. So I'm very excited for it. And I'm very excited to be learning, from you about, you know, just how turkeys are managed and a little bit more about the biology of turkeys here in Wisconsin. So I guess to kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about where you're from and kind of how you got to your position as game bird specialist in the DNR?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am located in the north central part of Wisconsin. I work out of the Anago office for the Wisconsin DNR. And when I first started in this position, I started focusing primarily as the assistant turkey and pheasant ecologist, primarily focusing on those upland game bird species. And then recently, within like the last year and a half, I have also taken on assistant migratory game bird duties as well. So now I kind of just focus and help my lead worker. I work under Taylor Finger, who is the lead game bird specialist for the state. And so now I'm his assistant, and we cover all things from migratory species, ducks, geese, doves, woodcock, and then getting into some upland, so turkey and pheasant, and a little bit of the grouse as well. So,
got it. That's fantastic. And so you're a Wisconsin native, right? Did you grow up hunting? And I guess what led you to your career in this space?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a Wisconsin native, originally from the southeast corner of the state, but I have a pretty extensive background and grew up hunting. And that started with primarily waterfowl hunting ever since I was a kid, like even tagging along younger than when I could actually start harvesting birds on my own at 12. But then I actually started to expand my hunting background and got into turkey hunting in my early teens, like early high school area. And so I haven't stopped since then. So, but initially my background started with migratory and waterfowl.
Got it.
Kind of
that's
expanded
awesome.
Into some upland species too.
Excellent. Yeah. And so was it the passion for chasing those birds and learning more about them through hunting kind of what led you to your interest in working in that space professionally? Or have birds always been an interest of yours?
Yeah, it really stemmed from my experience out in the field from hunting and just the interest for the species and the biology aspect of it. And actually being a part of the conservation work behind the scenes is what really drove me to seek a degree in the natural resources and then ultimately end up in my position here. So it really stemmed from that actual outdoor experience that led to a professional passion.
Yeah, totally. That's awesome. That's super cool. And I mean, cool that you've been able to, you know, carry that passion on from a young age, being in the outdoor space and, be able to manage and oversee the stuff that you, the birds and the animals that you chased growing up and everything. That's super cool. And, you know, I'm a late bird hunter, I guess you could say. I just started hunting birds for the first time in the form of turkeys back in 2020. That was like kind of my COVID hobby that I picked up with a buddy of mine. And then next thing you know, he got a bird dog and he got into duck hunting and stuff like that. And so I've sort of dabbled in it, but I'm still very green to the whole, really all things bird hunting. So I'm excited to be learning from you and especially learning more about some of the different populations and how things are managed here in Wisconsin. So I guess when it comes to
that's awesome.
Our turkey population is what we're really focused on right now, especially as turkey season's just about to kick off here across the state. So I guess when it comes to managing turkeys from a biological perspective or an ecological perspective, where do the priorities lie for you guys when it comes to overseeing turkey management?
Wildlife in general, one of our main management priorities would be habitat, but that is still tried and true for turkeys specifically. But turkeys, what we would focus on for their management is not only their habitat, but also harvest management and then some research aspects to that as well. But habitat being the overall encompassing main focus of their management, and then tying into of what myself and Taylor, the specialist, will focus on is we'll focus on kind of like their harvest management and things like that on a statewide scale.
Got it. Super cool. So we've talked about it quite a bit on this show about just how diverse the different environments are throughout the state, how the southern Wisconsin is vastly different than northern Wisconsin. How do those priorities change for you guys, especially when looking at turkeys? Or I guess, what does great turkey habitat look like throughout the state in those various kind of ecosystems?
Yeah, so historically, the eastern wild turkey is native to Wisconsin here. But their historical range was kind of ranging from that southwestern corner up through the central part of Wisconsin and then kind of tapering off once it got closer to that northern forest line. But turkeys are actually considered a generalist species where they can survive quite well in a variety of different kind of habitats, really as long as they have their main components of need. So they need a defendable food source, good quality roosting sites, but then the most crucial would be like nesting cover and brood rearing sites. And so that dynamic can change throughout the state, where the nesting and brood rearing sites, you'll hear a lot of habitat focused work for forest openings. That is a crucial part that you'll find more so of once you get farther north into the north woods. But just any kind of like landscape openings and good nesting cover. So that nesting cover, they need that kind of dense vegetation so the turkey poults can move freely on the ground to find insects to eat, but also have that cover for away from predators and things like that. But then get into more forestry for a turkey throughout their whole entire lifespan as well, that they need the forest openings, but also forest stands to have good roosting sites.
Got it. That totally makes sense. So openings in terms of like logging and stuff, which, obviously was a lot more popular in the 70s and 80s and early 90s and stuff across the state. I mean, there's still areas that still get logged, but, my mind wants to jump towards deer a little bit in that, you know, it sounds like they kind of have a similar priority in terms of what they need. And obviously the deer aren't roosting, but needing that ground cover, needing that forest floor to be opened up a little bit so that there can be that lateral cover for them. That's really interesting. And it makes me wonder too, you know, specifically for poults and, you know, turkeys as in general, what are some of the biggest predators that they need to be, you know, mindful of? Or if there's people who are, I don't know, my mind jumps to raccoons and skunks and possums and stuff raiding the nests, or coyotes grabbing poults and that kind of stuff. Is that accurate? Yeah. Or I'm just trying to think of from a private land standpoint, what are the things that we're folks see all the time that might be impacting their turkey flocks?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right with that list of predators that you gave. And pretty much the most crucial time or most vulnerable time of a turkey's life is going to be during that nesting and brood rearing season versus if you look at a tom, really they don't have as much of a predation issue as the young poults do versus, well, actually during the springtime throughout the year, one of their main and highest reasons for mortality is hunter harvest. But when you get into the early spring, that brood rearing season, the predators, like you said, can be those brown nest predators, but also a big one that people will overlook as well are those avian predators and those raptors. That can also be a concern, and not only with turkeys, but with other wildlife young species as well, whether that's waterfowl species or other ground nesting birds, getting into grouse and things like that. That's also predation concern as well.
Huh. That's fascinating.
And that's it's extremely crucial to have those opening areas that they can move freely on the ground, but also has that dense vegetation to kind of give them some shelter.
So one of the things that you mentioned there was, you know, with the raptors and everything, I'm assuming that, you know, it's primarily entailing hawks, falcons, eagles, stuff like that. Do owls play any effect in turkey predation?
A little bit, yes. Probably not as common or as abundantly as, you know, say hawks, per se.
Okay.
It's probably one of the most common ones that I could, you know, would see and hear of more often.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Makes sense. So I'm curious, you mentioned toms don't get nearly as much predation or I don't know. I just want to say like harassment almost like throughout the season of, you know, just getting chased around and all that. But I guess what does a year look like, or how do their priorities change throughout a 300, you know, a 12-month period for a Tom versus, you know, hens and poles?
Sure. So in general, with turkeys, a really significant influencing factor to their whole entire population dynamic and their kind of life cycle throughout the year would be the weather. That definitely changes their patterns a lot. So in the spring, and depending, and this can vary on what part of the state you're in. So me being up in the north, we might see more delayed getting into that spring breeding cycle versus that time of the year might start a bit earlier for those in the south when they lose a lot of that winter weather per se and that snow and the temperatures warm up sooner. So that will play a huge factor into when that breeding season will actually start and kick off. Because if it remains cold and snow on the ground, they tend to still stay in those grouped winter flocks versus dispersing to actually start breeding and finding suitable nesting sites for the hens, things like that. And so prime breeding and nesting season will start mid-April and then go through mid to late May. And you'll notice their vocalization change according to that too. So for toms, that's kind of when it'll start. And anywhere from mid-April to mid-May will kind of be peak. But then as soon as that breeding season slows down, you'll start to hear them get a little quieter. And then come fall is when they might molt their tail feathers and things like that and start to slow down and not really have much of an active drive or a purpose out there other than just surviving. And then later into the fall, coming into winter, is when they start to go back into those larger winter flocks.
Okay, got it. But they're kind of just roaming for the summers for the most part.
Yep. Yeah, so I mean, their main purpose is just eating and surviving outside of that breeding season.
Got it. That's interesting. I didn't realize that weather played so much of a role in the timing of, I guess, the turkey breeding season. You know, it's not. I was always curious if it had to do with, you know, if it was like whitetails where you're, you know, the amount of like. What's the word I'm looking for here? Photo period. Like the amount of daylight during the day, like impacted things, or if it was a temperature type of thing that played a role.
And that plays into it as well is you know, that amount of daylight and things like that. So.
Got it. That's interesting. And then the hens and the poults, they are, well, what's a year look like for them? They, you know, do the, I guess if we start from springtime here, this breeding season, they're tending the nests and then what?
Yeah, so hens will start looking for ideal nesting habitat in that early April-ish, kind of even before seeking out any kind of breeding companion and things like that. They'll start to scope out ideal nesting areas, get that established, and then getting into the breeding season with toms, but then actually having that clutch and raising that brood. Will come a little bit later, and so the when she lays a full clutch of eggs on a nest, the incubation period is roughly about 28 days, and then after that, it's really quick. It really only takes about 12 to 24 hours for those turkey poults to get up and get out of the nest, and once they are all hatched and start to leave that nest, they'll never come back to it. After that, they're gone. They are on the ground. Primarily focus on feeding and growing. And so their primary diet in the first few weeks of their life, at least a month, like anywhere between 4 to 6, maybe even 4 to 8 weeks, is heavily insect-dependent diet for high protein. But even then, after about, let's see, a few days, they can start to fly very short distances. But then after about a couple weeks here, So for brood rearing, it's about 2 weeks of age that they can actually fly into trees to start roosting with the hens.
No kidding.
The first few weeks, they are completely on the ground. So again, that's why that high vegetation is important to conceal from predators, to then also provide a insect-heavy diet for them with high protein.
Yeah, so definitely.
After that, the young will pretty much stay with the hen throughout that first year, because they're still really young, that they'll kind of follow the lead of that adult and that hen. And then it'll be time to, you know, fall and winter to get back into those larger winter flocks. And so after that, when they are at least a year old and getting more mature, then they'll start to disperse again when this whole breeding cycle will start over and a new year is up when they are more mature and considered a adult turkey to actually start to wander off on their own.
Sure.
But even Jake's too will tend to stay in larger groups through that first year.
Got it. That makes sense. So they really stay in that flock with their mom the entire for really the full year, it sounds like. And then once by the time they've reached that 365 day mark, give or take a few, that's when they finally are able to actually. So it's a relatively slow growth period for a turkey, aside from, it sounds like, those first handful of weeks when they're making those really big jumps.
It feels really quick, you know, getting out of the nest and within a day, and then they're kind of off focusing on feeding, things like that. That can go pretty quick. But then, you know, just toms are the different ones that are primarily going to be the ones who are going to really disperse to find hens to breed with, and then also hens dispersing on their own a little bit to find their own individual nesting sites. But then ultimately they'll come back into those winter flocks later in the year until the whole process starts over again in the spring.
Yeah, I like it. One of the things you noticed, or you mentioned there, was you know, hens finding that nesting site and you know, picking that out this time of year, kind of before, I guess, turkey season sort of starts for a lot of us hunters. Do hens tend to, I guess, let me put it this way. Do you tend to see a near proximity in the areas where toms and hens, you know, the toms are strutting and gobbling and maybe doing their breeding? Are they generally in fairly close proximity to the nesting site, or are they the toms hit the field top and then the hens get out of there? What's it look like?
Yeah, I mean, it could depend individually how far they travel to seek breeding mates and things like that. But so toms in that spring season, they focus on openings like forest openings or even openings over egg fields or prairies, things like that. They need that open visible space for their mating displays, for their strutting displays, to actually attract mates to breed with and things like that. And then it can also get into some territory issues with other males. And then hens, the nesting areas that they look for and nesting habitat that they look for is, if they're in the woodlands, they'll be found on woodland edges or within those openings as well. They might even find like larger logs or stumps, just for a little bit more of a structured concealment and structured protection. But they are going to be pretty much more concealed away from those vast openings where you'll find those toms kind of strutting around and things like that.
For sure. So when the hens are on the nest, when their eggs are, they're still eggs, right? when they're tending the nest, are the hens staying down there overnight, or do they watch the nest and they fly up to roost at night and then they're just in close proximity and then they drop back down and stay on it?
Nope, they are pretty much on that nest, and so that is one of the high risks for predation for hens is during that spring season as well, is them sitting on that nest is where they're a little bit more vulnerable versus toms is the opposite, where they're high risk and their high vulnerability in that spring time frame could be from hunter harvest and things like that.
Got it.
So totally the hens can be sense. Susceptible to predators as well as those bulls when they hatch. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Have you guys been able to figure out if there is any weight between the strutting and the gobbling that like one tends to work better for toms. It's like if they can sit up in a, on top of a field and gobble here and there, but just stand there full strut for an hour or so in the morning versus being somewhere where they have to just sit there and beller down into the draws and everything. Does one tend to like yield more success for them?
It really depends. I hear a lot of speculation in comments on vocalization versus strutting, or even just like vocalization in general, whether they're very vocal, not vocal, things like that. Mm-hmm. But nothing really solidified per se, sure. At least not that I've heard. So starting with vocalization is that it's communication. So in the spring, when you hear those very loud, booming, kind of aggressive gobbles, that tom is alerting everybody in the area, I'm here, calling out to hens to be like, hey, come over here, come find me. And then once hens are in the area and they have that visibility, you know, that's when they'll really, really turn up the whole actual strutting displays of it. Mm-hmm. And hens can have their own vocalizations too in the spring versus just any kind of clucks and purrs coming from both males and females. It's kind of simple, relaxed, but content. Communication with each other versus when hens, they'll have that, they refer to it as cutting, be a cutting call. That's kind of a hen's vocal call to males, yeah, that, hey, I'm here, I'm looking to be bred as well. Or it could be kind of, I'm a little aggravated kind of a thing. Typically, in general, a lot of those higher, almost more aggressive vocals from either males or females can also be kind of an alert call as well, mm-hmm. any time of the year. But yeah, the males and females will kind of have their more aggressive per se calls in the spring breeding season that will be associated with spring breeding activity.
Got it. That is fascinating. I didn't realize that the hens cutting was actually their, I guess, sort of equivalent to gobbling a little bit, or mm-hmm. I guess like letting the toms know that they're receptive. Mm-hmm. That's a big note for folks listening that they should be jotting down as turkey season approaches here. But that's fascinating. So I guess in your experience, and I guess from a biological standpoint too, like when you're in the field and say you rip some sharp cuts on your pot call, or your box call, or mouth, whatever it may be, you get that tom to fire back. Have you found a benefit to staying, like, I guess, at that volume or at that pitch or that intensity versus once they gobble back, dial it in a little bit?
Yes, it depends on the time mm-hmm. of the season per se, mm-hmm. and if they're going to be very active and very aggressive versus if it's very late in the season and the activity starts to taper off a little bit, where they don't really, you know, they care less. But initially, in like right away, if you're out there in the morning, if you get out there before the roost, a lot of those louder vocalizations is just primary purpose is for locating them. Mm-hmm. If you can get them to call, you know, gobble back at you, it's a great sign, you know, of where they are in the area in proximity to where you're sitting or where you're set up. So that's great. And then it's the whole dance of getting them to come into your area without doing too much. You know, what is that fine line of enough? Can I keep gobbling? Can I keep calling the have them be receptive of it versus what is too much that it might push them away, things like that. So it's really that fine line dance with them in the field that you'll kind of have to feel out in the moment. Mm-hmm. And so maybe early season, things like that, where they might be a little bit more aggressive to it, start off with those heavy gobbles and calls for locating them and seeing where they're at. But if you notice them actually coming into your area, like say you got decoys out there, then maybe you'd back off a little bit so you don't kind of scare them off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally makes sense. Well, that's kind of exactly what I was asking there. Does it pay more early season to be more aggressive with the calls, and then as you get later into the year? Because I mean, we've got a fairly long
turkey season,
right?
Yeah. So I mean, it depends, because once you get later in the year, it might take more work to get those birds to be more receptive to you and try to get them to do what you want or get them in the area that you want. Mm-hmm. So you might even have to be a little bit more aggressive to get their attention. So I would just say, like, earlier in the year, you know, when they are driven for a specific purpose, it just might take a little bit more finesse. And then later in the season, very late season, it just might take more work, per se.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes sense.
But I mean, turkeys are one of those, you know, like, you're scouting up to prior, you feel like you got them patterned down to a science, like the, you know, exact time of the day, everything. And then you get out there and then who knows? They might just decide to switch up on you, and, you know, the flip of a switch, different day, completely different activity. So that's why it's super important to be out there turkey scouting when you can, and just kind of watching and listening to where they're at and what they're doing.
Yeah, definitely. How have you seen turkey vocalizations differ depending on the weather?
This is always a topic that tying in with our hunting season structure as well. Everyone is always seeking like those early time periods, A and B, and everyone's like, so there's some people who are adamant, nope, they are not vocal at all, late season, this and that. And it really can depend. Like if the weather's good, then maybe they'll still be out there and still be active. Versus, as I was getting to earlier, we have like a lingering winter where it might just delay that spring breeding just a little bit. They might not be as vocal until things really start to warm up, things like that. But I mean, personal experience, I was turkey hunting, it was zone 2 last year, but I was late. I was time period D, and they were still really vocal, pretty active and aggressive. So, I mean, it was kind of strange to see where people say like mid-season vocalization really turns down. But I don't know. We also had a very, very mild winter and early spring last year. This year, too, it's been somewhat of a mild winter. We've had a little bit more winter precipitation and a couple more like cold snaps. Luckily, they weren't too extensive, like too long. Last a few days or a week or so, at least up in the north woods where I'm at, and kind of warm up again a little bit, maybe back and forth. So not as mild as last year, but not super crazy. We've definitely seen worse. So yeah, the colder it is, I would say probably a little bit more mellow they are.
Okay, got it. Same goes for like rain or like high wind days.
Yep.
Gotcha.
It could depend. I mean, that's always a hard one too, because you never know. It depends on where you're set up and if you are set up in the field, because they might be calling, but maybe if you're completely in the wrong direction and that wind is carrying it elsewhere that you just can't hear them, kind of a thing. So that one's always a tough one to kind of gauge.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier there that you see everybody when we apply for tags, everybody's trying to get those first couple periods and everything. Have you found, you know, just in managing turkeys and looking at harvest data and everything, are those first two turkey periods all that they're cracked up to be? Or have you found period 3 or 4 or 5? Like, is there any season that tends to be kind of like, this is consistently the highest harvest period?
Sure. So we do track hunter success rate generally statewide or just for the zone, but also for each period. But the thing with looking at it on a fine-tuned scale of looking at it for each individual time period, that can also have a heavy influence on hunter participation. So with early seasons kind of being the most popular and sought after, and all of the tags will be gone in that initial drawing, like no bonus tags are left over, versus some zones, I believe, like even currently, there's still a bunch of bonus tags out left for sale. So like zones 1 and 3 and even like 2 and 4 will have either the last two or the last time period of the season with some bonus tags left for sale. Mm-hmm. So hunter participation can also be a huge influence in what would determine that hunter success rate.
Sure.
So I can pull up the harvest from last year. And overall, we had a really good hunter success rate statewide across all of zones of about 22.5. And this was actually, I looked earlier, 2024 had the third highest harvest since like our modern day turkey hunting seasons since the mid 80s. So it was a really great year. But for actual harvest success for time period, you'll see higher harvest rates in that A through C mm-hmm. range, and then they'll start to taper off.
Got it. Yeah, I just wasn't sure if there was like an actual like sign. Well, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. Our turkey season is 6 weeks long. Right. And we've got a youth season the weekend prior. So like mm-hmm. approximately 6 weeks or so. You mentioned it's kind of weather dependent, but how much of the turkey breeding season does our actual hunting season cover? Like, are they starting to breed now in some of the southern states or southern counties where it might be a little bit more warm and everything? Or I guess, when does it typically kick off?
Yeah, so actually, historically, a few years ago, our hunting season used to be structured a week earlier. Mm-hmm. And then a few years back, it got pushed a week later. And the main idea behind that and reasoning for that was to ensure successful breeding to take place early in the spring, like early in that breeding season, just to mm-hmm. ensure for a successful turkey production that year. And so there's a lot of back and forth where there's some folks who definitely want to bump it back up to that week before versus staying where we're at the current week that we start. But yes, like when we start our season, turkey nesting and breeding has already started to take place.
Got it.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, it'll really start to focus like early April is when they'll start looking for nesting sites and then getting into breeding.
Gotcha. So they're not being hunted for the entire breeding season, at least. We give them a chance to, mm-hmm. you know, get some nest going early there. That's interesting. And I'm curious, and I'll start here. How did you guys assess turkey populations and like the numbers of birds on a landscape or like poult success? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you guys keep tabs on that and actually get your numbers that way?
Sure. So this is one of my most common questions, but also one mm-hmm. of my toughest questions because we really just don't have like an overall, like a statewide or even like a zone-wide population estimate or a population mm-hmm. density. So what we look at to kind of monitor the turkey population is we'll look at surveys, like breeding surveys, and then looking at that hunter harvest. And so historically, we used to have what was called the 10-week brood survey, and that took place through that brood rearing season. But the last year that was conducted was 2019. 2020 was the year of COVID. Couldn't really do a lot of our surveys. But the issue that we were experiencing with that specific 10-week brood survey for turkeys is that we were noticing a drastic decline in participation and observations mm-hmm. where we just weren't confident in having any actual trends from the data that we were getting just because we weren't getting that participation. But on a great note is that we've updated a game bird brood survey a couple years back. So this will be going into our fourth year of it, our fourth summer. And so it's called our game bird brood survey, where we focus on turkeys and other upland species, so pheasant, grouse, and it is a great survey that both wildlife professionals, but also the members of the public can participate in it as well. And it's done right on your smartphone with a free app called Survey123. And then you just set up our actual game bird brood survey on that app. And it's great because it can take an actual GPS pinpointed location observation. So you just follow prompts, enter in what you see, like how many birds you see, male, female, if you see any poults, how many poults. And then it literally has GPS mapping capabilities where it can take a live and more accurate location observation. Yeah. And then you just submit it. So it's super easy, quick. And then that has been taking place through the month of August. And so you'll see broods a lot earlier than that. But why we had it done in August is because we really wanted to focus on actual production levels, like what turkeys are going to be coming into our population and adding into our population. Because early on in that nesting and brood rearing season, you know, for example, say a hen might have a clutch of 12 bolts somewhere around there. But then maybe towards the end of the summer and end of the season, when those are starting to grow, she might only have 3 to 6 kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so some of the main metrics that we focus on with that survey would be poults per hen and poults per brood. And so last year of 2024, the observations were slightly down from 2023, but there was significant notes and comments statewide that a lot of folks were seeing broods in July and maybe not as frequent and not as much in August. And we think that was due to, you know, we have that really mild winter and like early spring conditions where that kind of kickstarted the whole breeding season. Mm-hmm. And so we were just a little bit later than what we anticipated, but still really great numbers. On average, over 2 poults per hen, which is good. It's in the positive.
Really? Mm-hmm. So the I guess poult survival rate's that low for turkeys. I guess for 2 to survive per hen, it seems low.
Yeah, and that's that's just an average. Okay. But then there's also that poults per brood, which is a little bit different. So that is the poults per brood is just over 3 was the average for 2024.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Poults per hen, it was about 2.5 from 2024. And it was actually at about 3 in 2023.
Okay, got it. Interesting. So we've been talking about, you know, poult success and poult survival quite a bit. Is that kind of the leading indicator that you guys are focused on when you're trying to get a gauge or estimate the health of a flock or a turkey population in areas, what their survival rate is? Or how much weight is like, oh, I saw 6 toms, you know, during season B or something like that. And, you know, mm-hmm. a handful of hens, like is one, I guess, demographic of turkey give you guys better information or paint a better picture of the overall population than another?
Yeah. So when it comes to these spring and summer breeding surveys for wildlife is really, turkey specifically, yes, is that poult per hen ratio of what we want to see of what is actually going to be introduced into the new future turkey population. But still within that game bird brood survey, you can log everything that you see. So it's not just hens or poults. So you can log and record any jakes, toms, things like that. And that will also give us good metrics and good data to look at just the abundance of certain areas and things like that. But then we'll primarily focus on hunter harvest to see if that has any indication to the population. So,
okay, got it.
Like for 2024, we had a really great season, great harvest success rate, and then still great birds on the landscape, coordinating it with that spring and summer brood rearing survey. of turkey abundance, whereas if we were to see like a drastic drop in hunter harvest and things like that, that would be an indicator that we would have to look into the actual population further. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, gotcha. That's interesting. You know, it makes me wonder too, in terms of hunters taking a certain number of birds off the landscape every year, have you guys noticed in areas of, you know, say high hunter density, does an area take longer to recover if, say, I don't know, X number of toms get harvested this year? Do you tend to see a lull the following year? Or I guess how long does it take for that population to rebound or restabilize, or to hopefully those jakes just fill those spots, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might take a little bit more of a deep dive into the data mm-hmm. we have, and like going back a few years, or, you know, at least a decade, to like see any trends, things like that. And so here in Wisconsin, with our season and our tag system, is that you can have multiple harvest tags. Like our harvest, like our bag limit is just one bird per harvest authorization. Or in the spring, it's just one male or bearded bird. Fall's a little different. But we find that hunters who harvest more than two birds a year is a very, very low percentage. And so I think that that question that you're getting at can be even more of a fine-tuned local
sure.
variable, even more fine-tuned than just our seven turkey management zones, because this will tie into kind of their biology and like their whole dynamic and that flock dynamic. So say you're hunting an area and you have like one really dominant tom who it's safe to assume that he's going to be the primary breeder in that local area versus if you have multiple. And then it might take them some time, you know, days or weeks to reestablish their pecking order, see who's the more dominant tom now that's going to be breeding hens, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So that can be a more smaller scale, fine-tuned detail.
Yeah, got it. That's fascinating. You know, that makes me wonder too, on the note of establishing that pecking order, I've heard that every morning at fly down, if you've got multiple toms in an area, they're fighting to reset the pecking order. Is that true? Do they do that on a daily basis? Or does one, I'm sure maybe they do it, but that dominant bird continuously, you know, knocks all of them off his pedestal. But how does that look?
Like you said earlier, you kind of want to go back and kind of compare things to deer. But I mean, male toms can be like male deer fighting for the female in the area. And that's why, like, early season when they're more active, a little bit more aggressive, like guys will have their videos of this big tom coming and actually starting to fight their decoy. You see multiple birds, multiple males fighting in the area. That's their dominance and their territory, and that is what they're fighting for with breeding those hens. So you'll definitely actually see that out in the field if you're lucky. So those are always some of the really cool hunts and why a lot of folks want to hunt early season.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Do you tend to see, it sounds like early season then is the better opportunity to hunt with decoys, maybe, because I've heard that by late season the toms are tired, they're sick of fighting with each other, and they don't want to pick a fight if they don't have to, because they're just worn down.
Potentially. Potentially. But yeah, you know, like I said earlier too, with calling, like later season, maybe it just might take a little bit more effort. But still, depending on the year and, you know, depending on weather and patterns and things like that, they still might be pretty active. And you'll see toms strutting in the fall or in the winter. And that's still a dominance and a territory thing. They're like, maybe the young ones in the area are just annoying them for the day, and they gotta remind them kind of who's boss and whose field that they're kind of walking in, kind of a thing. So you'll see their dominance being shown to others throughout the season, not only in the spring season. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of also a tough one when you're comparing early season versus later season for in the spring hunting season, because they can still be pretty active, but maybe just not as active and as aggressive.
Yeah.
As
is there
right
any
away.
Right. Is there any weight that should be put into, I guess weight's the wrong words. What do you make of toms that are, I mean, I think a lot of us have been out during the 9-day rifle season for deer and heard, either seen toms strutting up in a field or heard the random shot gobbles at gunshots at sunrise and stuff like that. Is there any, I guess, what are they doing? Is it still just the dominance display when they're in their winter flocks and everything? They're just trying to make sure that everybody knows that they're the top dog still, but are the gobbles doing the same, basically trying to achieve the same effect?
Yeah. And you know, as we were discussing vocalizations a little bit earlier, even throughout like the winter and fall outside of that spring season and breeding season, a lot of the more louder, aggressive, high-pitched vocals can also be indicators of more alert communication. Maybe something's going on in the area or like a predator alert and things like that. But when you see more physical displays and strutting displays, it's really just kind of a dominance display or territory display, things like that.
Got it. Makes sense. Yeah, so kind of circling back to vocalizations and calling and stuff, we hear you need to know how to do your cuts, your clucks, your purrs, your key runs, all sort of that stuff. What did some of those sounds I guess mean to turkeys or in the turkey woods? Like, what are some of those different vocalizations? You mentioned cutting's kind of like the equivalent to hens gobbling, but like some of those more subtle sounds that we hear birds making.
Yeah. So, I mean, spring specific gobbles in the spring, kind of just alerting the surroundings of where they're located, things like that. Also calling out to attract and saying, hey, I'm here, kind of a thing. They're breeding things. Cutting for hens, that can be their more loud and vocal vocalizations where they're also communicating to the tom saying, hey, I'm receptive, looking for a community for breeding. Or it could be kind of a louder vocalization saying that they're kind of agitated, things like that. But when you get into the more subtle and softer ones like purring or just clucks, that's just like general communication and usually a good indicator that they're content. Like they're pretty happy, content, and comfortable in their setting that they're in, like the flock that they're in, things like that. And what you said, those never really hear too often, but those
Kiki runs, yeah,
the Kiki runs, those are primarily going to be those younger birds, kind of like, hey, where are you guys? Making sure that they stay together, that they don't kind of get lost out on their own. So also a very communication-based location where they're at.
Got it. Is that primarily the hens making those kikis, or is it the poults looking for
it
mom?
Could be the young ones too, yeah.
Okay,
the young
got it.
Ones kind of like, hey, I'm lost, where are you? Don't go too far without me, kind of a thing. So
got it. Totally makes sense. Circling back to management and stuff like that and kind of gaining data and building stuff, I think a lot of folks have always wondered, how are the turkey zones selected?
Yeah, so this kind of goes back way back into our more modern day turkey hunting season. So in general, kind of starting from the beginning, is that the Eastern wild turkey is one of our greatest wildlife success stories, we like to say. So the Eastern wild turkey, they are native to Wisconsin, but in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they are almost completely exasperated from the state due to deforestation and market hunting, unregulated hunting, things like that. And throughout the 1900s, early 1900s, there was some early reintroduction efforts, but they ultimately failed. Largely was due to they tried using like a pen-reared bird versus like an actual true genetically wild bird. But it was actually in 1976, I want to say, for 1979, there was 29 turkeys that were released in the Bad Axe River in Vernon County. Mm-hmm. And so Wisconsin, we had an agreement with the Missouri Department of Conservation to trade We traded wild ruffed grouse from Wisconsin, and in return, we got true wild eastern wild turkeys from Missouri that we located here and released into ideal habitat pockets in that southwestern corner. And once those populations were established and those flocks kept growing larger and larger, Wisconsin, we actually did some intertranslocation efforts and pulled birds from those original population concentrations and put them in other areas of the state as well to expand that. And so now we have healthy populations of turkeys in every county in the state. So we have that 1 through 7, pretty much a statewide hunting opportunity in both the spring and the fall. But in those early years of, it was in the mid-80s that we started of what was considered our more modern day spring turkey hunting seasons, there used to be 46 turkey management zones. So quite a bit.
Holy
it was
smokes.
Really broken down a lot to more of a fine-tuned scale to really look at smaller scale populations versus harvest. But as the populations and translocations grew and became more successful, hunters were really expressing the need for a little bit more flexibility and availability to go and hunt other areas, because they still had a similar process to what we have now with drawing tags, and the tags are zone specific, so you can only hunt in your zone. And with those zones being a lot smaller, you were restricted a lot more to where you can actually hunt. And then, so listening to those concerns from the public, actual habitat managers looked at, really when you looked at an area of multiple smaller turkey management zones, the habitat landscape wasn't too much different across multiple of them. And so it dropped down to our current 7 in 2009, I believe, was when we established our current 7 turkey management zones.
That's crazy that there used to be that many. That had to be a nightmare 46. To keep track of. Oh my gosh.
And then there's also like state parks in Fort McCoy. Fort McCoy is still a little bit separate. It's kind of like their own zone. They have their own tags, things like that. But we'll still incorporate their data and turkey hunter harvest data into our statewide stuff as well.
Yeah, for sure. That's interesting because, you know, we've talked with Jeff Pritzel, the state deer program specialist on here, and kind of how they went from having a similar case where they had all these, you know, small like micro zones almost throughout the state that they were trying to manage deer in. And then they eventually switched to counties. Now they're talking about potentially switching back to the more, I guess, landscape divided, like landscape oriented deer zones and stuff like that to keep better tabs on things. Do you guys see any need to do a similar thing with turkeys, or are things, they seem to be working pretty darn well with that?
I believe that they're working pretty well. 7 seems to be a decent number. Like when you look at actual different landscapes throughout the state, and you can kind of see like geographical differences, it makes sense to where they are. But really what we'll be focusing on what is a big topic of discussion every year, as every year we set them in, individually, is the amount of harvest authorizations per zone. That's something that we review and set on an annual basis. So we always have this topic of discussion, but it's more so looking at the levels of harvest authorizations in each zone versus where the zones are themselves. There has been a couple topics come up, primarily with zone 2, just because it's a fairly large zone, going all the way in that bottom southeast corner and going all the way up through like that Door County Peninsula and things like that. There's been some discussion of maybe reworking that area, but ultimately it would come down to like the hunter harvest tag availability and kind of your drawing odds. And so even if, say, for example, even if we were to split that in any way, that wouldn't necessarily change the number of harvest authorizations that we would allot It would just kind of give it a different entrepreneur.
So. Sure. Yeah, that's interesting because I've talked to a handful of folks who have expressed, I guess, a little bit of frustration with how quickly those zone two tags get picked up there. And it makes sense because you've got the whole Milwaukee area. You've got the east mm-hmm. half of Madison. You've got Oshkosh. You've got some like the southern Green yeah. Bay area all the way up to Door County. Yep. Like it's a massive zone, mm-hmm. which I didn't really realize it was that big until I took a look at the map this year. Holy yep. smokes, that's a lot of people fighting for turkey tags.
Yeah, but it has, you know, the big metropolitan high population centers within that zone as well. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's interesting, though, that they, even if you did divide zone two into two zones there, the number of tags stays the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we would just still split it, basically. Yeah. So, yeah, huh. there's kind of always that debate, but it is, you know, a topic that in conversation we don't ever overlook it. We discuss it every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, and I, you know, it's one thing if it's deer, and we've obviously got a big CWD problem going on right mm-hmm. now that is affecting the deer herds and the populations pretty substantially there. Are there any threats or like diseases or anything? I know we hear about waves of avian flu kind of making their rounds and everything. Is there anything that's really like a big threat to turkeys in Wisconsin right now?
There are, you know, some general wildlife diseases that are always a concern, can always be there and be present on the landscape. But so far with turkeys, we're sitting pretty content, fingers crossed, knocking on wood. but because avian influenza is primarily seen in like those migrant species, where turkeys are a more localized, smaller home range species, and yeah. they might not be coming into contact with a lot of the other species who are like the main carriers of it. So far, we haven't had a high concern of avian influenza with our wild turkey population. We have tested turkeys if any kind of weird circumstance, and with all of the carcasses that have been tested for turkeys, it has all been negative for avian influenza so far. And that's been from when the height of avian influenza started to kick up again in 2022. So
got it. That's awesome. I mean, good to know at least that
yeah
that
ultimately the turkeys are just doing a well. Different landscape and different interaction with mm-hmm. the carrying species.
Yeah, definitely. Although I did have a couple of Canadian geese fly into my turkey decoys last spring. That was a little concerning, so they might be carrying. I don't know.
yeah.
That's really interesting. That's awesome to know. On the note of, oh, I just had a total brain fart. Give me one sec. It's going to come back to me.
Yeah.
On the note of studies, and like gathering turkey data and everything, are you guys doing any sort of like I know with deer, we have, like our deer collaring surveys and stuff mm-hmm. to track movement and that kind of stuff. Is there anything that you guys are doing on the turkey side of things, like that, like tracking yes. animals or anything?
Yeah. So actually there is a study that this winter was the second field season of it. So it's a fairly new study, but it's led by our upland research scientist Chris Volunteer, and it's taking place in like the central Wisconsin near Sand Hill wildlife area. Mm-hmm. And I actually got to go and help out a little bit. So it's a really cool operation and it was a great opportunity, but they are tracking some turkey movements, but also giving them a wing tag and a leg band for identification purposes. And so the goal of it and hopes to use trail cam photo imaging also in correlation with monitoring turkey population and during that nesting and broodering season. So Wisconsin, we have a program called Snapshot Wisconsin, where the members of the public can participate with sharing their trail cam images with us for identifying wildlife on the landscape. And so, you know, every year we get an abundance of turkey images throughout this program. And in that broodering season through the spring and summer, you know, we can see those broods and those poles. So this study would help determine is if using photo image data from that program would also be a viable source of data to also look at turkey production numbers and brood numbers and things like that. So that's been great. So in the winter, they've been trapping turkeys, and each bird will get a leg band and a wing tag. It kind of looks like a cattle, like an ear tag, bright colored with a number on it. That will be on their wing, and then the hens will get a GPS transmitter, and that they can get pinpointed locations at various intervals. They'll have them, you know, during the nesting and brood rearing season. They'll come more frequently, and then they can track those hens through their nesting period and then through their brood rearing period. And then we can also go do some ground truthing surveys of some flush surveys to actually count the poults on the ground in person and compare that to images that we get from the trail cameras.
Got it. That's awesome. Yeah. That's super cool. That's got to be awesome data to look at.
Yeah.
Is it primarily, like, what are you guys looking at the most in there? Is it just like locations of nesting sites versus in relation to trees, or what kind of stuff are you looking at?
Yep, it's going to be a lot of like location based. So it's going to be those nesting sites, but then also focusing on identification, you know, and why the main purpose of having those bright wing tags with a numerical number on it to is to identify individual birds. You know, you can see a turkey come up on multiple cameras in the same area, but is it the same turkey? Is it a different turkey? You know, is it the same hen and same brood that we're seeing, or is it a different one? So that's the primary focus on that, is also making sure we can identify them as well.
Got it. I like it. That's super cool. Yeah, that's got to be interesting data to be combing through, I guess, throughout a season and everything. That's really awesome. Alyssa, I've had you on here for about an hour, and I want to make sure that you're able to, I'm interrupting your work day, so I want to make sure that you're able to get back to that.
Yeah, sure. No worries.
But before we wrap up, are there any thoughts or advice that you have for folks who are setting out into the turkey woods next week that you'd like to leave them with before we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in general, if you're ever interested in any kind of turkey information or turkey management, the DNR's website is a great place to start, versus whether you're interested on the management information aspect, or if you're looking to get some more information on research or surveys, things like that. But also, we have great resources out there for hunters of explaining our season process, or if you need that turkey management zone map, things like that. Otherwise, some great mapping tools as well that might be able to point you in the right direction for accessing some public lands for turkey hunting as well. So,
Yeah, definitely.
That's always a great place to start. And I'm always open to contacts as well if anybody has any specific questions and wants some further details on anything. I'm always happy to talk turkeys with folks. So.
Awesome. I love it. Well, Alyssa, I can't thank you enough for your time today and for all the knowledge that you dropped on us here. Good luck to you this spring, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon here. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Good luck to you as well, and good luck to all those other turkey hunters out there, and I hope everyone has a safe and successful spring season.
That's all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, if you could leave me a 5-star review, I would appreciate that a ton. You can also follow along with my outdoor adventures on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at The Wisconsin Sportsman. That's also the best way to get a hold of me to suggest topics, guests, or questions you'd like me to explore on this show. Big thanks to our awesome partners, XOP, Onyx, Huntworth, Good Chance Fly Fishing, and the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Please go support the brands that support this show, and if you're looking for more awesome outdoor content, go check out thesportsmansempire.com, where you'll find a ton of other outdoor podcasts. And until next time, make sure you make the time to get outside and enjoy the incredible natural resources that are ours as Wisconsin sportsmen.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
I saw this app.
I got a hit.
In the new limited series, DTF St. Louis, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, and Linda Cardellini star as three suburbanites who spice up their love lives.
Wow.
Don't miss the new HBO original limited series, DTF St. Louis, premiering March 1st on HBO Max.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.